This podcast is rated S for science and also for spoilers and swearing. There's going to be swearing.
Something is killing these people and sucking them dry.
Run! It's a stampede!
All right, welcome everybody to Cinematic Animalia, the podcast where we take a famous movie monster, famous movie king of the monsters, or a famous movie monster, and look at how they might work in the real world by looking at their ecology and physiology. Today, we are doing the king of the motherfucking monsters. Yeah. We've been building up to this for a while. We're finally here with a recent release of Godzilla King of the Monsters. Before I get into that, I'm joined today by co-host number two, Davet, or Dave, as he is commonly known. We may be joined later or not by Adam. He's currently spelunking his way out of a 15th century cave, and the reception down there is not fantastic.
No.
So...
I mean, the last thing we heard from him is, that's no cave, but I'm sure that's not anything that we should be concerned about. He'll be fine.
It'll be fine. I'm sure he's not battling Morlocks. What's the thing from the time machine?
Yeah. Morlocks. Morlocks.
Morlocks. Yeah. Morlocks. Okay. Good. Right. Yeah. Okay. So obviously, this week we are looking at Godzilla, the most recent incarnation, the American incarnation.
Mm-hmm.
Sorry, I should say the most recent American incarnation, because there's been two new incarnations of Godzilla since the 2014 movie came out. But we are definitely looking at the 2014...
The Ferris Bueller-less version.
Yes, we might look at that version, the 1998 American version, at some point in the future, because it's got some interesting aspects. There's a lot of interesting stuff to talk about in terms of the asexual reproduction.
Yeah, I'd look at the babies. The babies would be fun.
Yeah. That's kind of an... but look, we're not looking at that today. We are looking at the 2014 version. What we'll do next week is go into a bit of the cinematic history of Godzilla. But for now, like, we had mixed feelings on this. I was just saying that I loved the film initially. I've gone a bit cold on it since, just because the human characters in the first Godzilla film in 2014 are really boring. I love the monster bit, mm-hmm. though. I think, Dave, you kind of agree with me. You just feel a little more strongly about
it. I just didn't. One, I felt we'd been lied to. They were like, oh, Bryan Cranston, he's going to be huge in this film. And then it was like, oh, 10 minutes in and he's dead. Okay, that's great.
Yeah.
And I really like Aaron Taylor-Johnson, but I found his entire storyline was just kind of, with Elizabeth Olsen, was flimsy and... Yeah. Like, his capabilities in terms of what he was able to do, like, suddenly he's a bomb-disarming agent that also has parachute training, and it was like, okay, I don't know where we're going with this.
I don't like that character. And so when I found out that, oh, he's going to be our focal point for the movie, I was just like, but I got enough cool Godzilla.
Yeah. And the Mewtwo, yeah. or the Mewtwo fights are, they're fun.
Yeah. My favorite moment of that. A lot of people like the Godzilla ripping the Mewtwo's head off, but I loved the, like, when the dun 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 dun, and you could see the atomic breath was about to come. I lost my shit.
Yeah, everybody.
That's
did.
All I'd wanted. Yes. Yeah, it was fantastic.
Although I still have problems with, and we'll go into this, why he's hunting the Mewtwo's, and yeah, we'll get into that as the show goes on.
Yeah. Yeah, so a lot of what we talk about this week is just Godzilla focused. Next week we'll be talking about the ecology of Godzilla. That'll rely a little bit on what's coming out in this film that's out at the moment. It seems to have had a lot, like the last film in 2014 had quite a few positive reviews. I think it did quite well critically. This time around, the reception seems to be a lot
not
more
great.
Mixed. Yeah, but I'm still going to go see it. I was just saying before, my favorite reaction to this has been that of a certain Twitter user who, in response to the AV Club's article, which was captioned, you can't just have 2 hours of monsters slapping each other around like a gargantuan WWE highlights reel, responded with, that's exactly what you can have, you dumb motherfuckers. And I am 100% on board with that. I could not agree more. So, just as an intro to the character of Godzilla as he's portrayed in these movies, what do you need to know going into this episode, Dave?
I think the big thing that you need to know for this film is that Godzilla is a creature born of radiation. It seems to differ between film to film exactly whether or not he's born of radiation created by the U.S. military or whether or not he's born of radiation from the Earth. For the 2014 one, we're going from ancient creature that subsists off ambient radiation from the planet. He is enormous. In terms of he's a very big boy. His weight and his size seem to sort of vary from film to film, but the final consensus of a lot of the material that I was reading felt that he was approximately 355 feet tall or 108 meters, and he had a suggested weight of approximately 90,000 pounds. And
he's portrayed as like this primordial being. They never exactly give like an idea of when these creatures roam the earth, but we can get into a little bit of that next week.
And ancient is a big range, saying like, oh well, he existed before humans. I mean, humans have existed for a tenth of an eye blink in the history of the universe and the history of the planet. So saying like, oh yeah, they were on Earth before us is not really...
And primordial is a very subjective term. A lot of weight behind that. But the other thing you need to know is that he can breathe.
Radiation?
Not
atomic
fire.
Atomic breath is...
I guess...
we'll get into that.
Godzilla. Godzilla. Godzilla.
Dave, you want to kick us off with the physiology of 2014's iteration of Godzilla?
Sure. So as we sort of briefly discussed, he's a big boy in the film, standing at his...
with a chonk.
Yeah, and I mean, he's got a pretty heavy base. He's got sort of a reptilian appearance to him. He seems to exist primarily in the ocean within the film, and it's believed that he's been asleep for the last, nobody's really clear on their date, but, you know, thousands of years. That he somehow has the ability to absorb and feed off of radiation, hence why he does have appearances at like the Kyoto event, or why he has appearances that involve a nuclear sub. But other than that, he's just kind of his own animal. In terms of within the context of the film, it's sort of discussed that the Mutos are responsible for the death of earlier versions of the Godzilla, absorbing their own form of radiation and then laying eggs within their remains. And one of the reasons that it's believed that Godzilla wakes up from his slumber and sort of comes onto land to try and hunt the Mutos has to do with he wants to wipe them out because he's afraid that they're going to wipe him out, is sort of the understanding that we get roughly from a couple of, I want to say scientists, but I could also say... drunk hobos that have stumbled onto screen wearing lab jackets.
That whole he's going to bring balance. It's like, this is not how that
not
works.
Really how nature works.
Unless Godzilla is just a creature with a very high level of intelligence who's just really obsessed with feng shui, and he feels that these Mutos are really fucking up the planet's feng shui.
So in terms of the primary subjects that I'm going to talk about, I obviously have to briefly discuss the size thing, but I'm not really going to go into detail. We've talked about that in King Kong. We've talked about it with lots of other episodes. But the primary three subjects that I'm going to sort of focus on for today are, one, because it'll make Sam happy, his atomic breath. Two, feeding off of radiation in terms of like radiation as an energy source. And then three... terrestrial and aquatic survival, so basically surviving in both environments. And so as a general size discussion, again, he's gonna have an enormous heart. I read a whole bunch of stuff online of different people sort of calculating it, and they've got similar measurements to sort of what I'd come up with, you know, this absolutely enormous heart with, you know, 530,000 gallons of blood that would be sort of pumped within everything. He's going to have incredible weight on his skeleton. He's not actually going to be capable of jumping. His body plan actually works a lot better than Godzilla's does, in terms of, like, he's got a much more solid base as a...
King Kong, yes.
Yeah, in terms of, he's got a much more solid base to sort of keep his weight on. The tail wouldn't really work. I mean, it might work as a swimming adaptation, but actually the tail is far too, like, tiny in the film. It's a very, very thin tail. If he was going to use it for the purposes of actually helping him with locomotion, he would need a much thicker, longer tail, more similar to what we see with, like, an alligator or a crocodile.
So there's an old Toho movie where he rears up on his tail, powers himself forward, and kicks his adversary with both feet off the ground.
Yeah.
Do you think that's... Yeah, would he be able to pull that?
No. But I mean, if he wanted a broken tail, yes, 100%.
Probably collapse backwards and break his spine
as
well.
Yeah, which would be a really depressing end of the film, because it would be the other monster feeling really, really bad and kind of wandering off his embarrassment as we have to follow another 2 hours of Godzilla going through rehab, multiple surgeries, and then, you know, trying to gain back his family as he succeeds where no other Godzilla has done before.
It's a different film.
Yeah. I mean, still very watchable, still something I'd be interested in seeing, but not the film that they were going for.
No, not really. Yeah.
Now, to get on to the topics that I think are going to be more interesting to discuss, because again, just as a disclaimer, he won't work from a size perspective. He doesn't work in terms of his breath, everything else. But we're going to ignore those.
We're going to get into that next week from an ecology perspective as well. Because I've kind of touched on it before, the whole body size relating to home range kind of thing. But I think we're going to treat next week as like as an attempt to kind of flesh that idea out and explain to people why this sort of thing just doesn't work.
So on to the more interesting topic, which is the atomic breath discussion. So within the 2014 film, while Godzilla is fighting one of the Mutos, there is this fantastic scene where he starts to charge up, his spikes turn blue. I was in a theater at the time where everybody sort of like took a deep breath, and then suddenly he roars as this extreme blast of blue energy shoots from his mouth, cooking a big chunk of the Muto. And
just beautiful cinematic.
So good. It won't work in the real world. No. So I did a bunch of reading and going through, and we're going to talk a little bit about this, but first of all, it can't be atomic. You can't generate radiation in nature. As much as people like to bring up different animals and they're like, oh, the cockroach is resistant to an atomic bomb. No. A cockroach is semi-resistant to certain forms of radiation that would be experienced in the fallout. But if a cockroach is sitting right next to the nuclear bomb, it ends up like everything else does, as a smoldering pile of ash in a crater where everything used to be.
So when they say that, like for instance, Chernobyl, recent series on HBO, would a cockroach have been able to survive in close proximity to Chernobyl?
Yeah, theoretically, and I mean, I'm not saying that every cockroach would survive. That's the other distinction that we have to make here. They're going to have resistant mechanisms to avoid, and we're going to get into this, certain forms of mutation or alteration or internal organ damage. But there's still going to be lots of cockroach deaths. There's going to be lots of cockroach mutations. One organism, you can't, that's not the way radiation works. Now when Godzilla seems to charge this up, there's sort of this electrical noise that's generated. So the two ideas that I sort of played with, because I read a lot of different things online, the first of which is that what he's going to be breathing is an actual flame. That it's not going to be radiation, but like similar to the dragons or the other creatures that we talked about, he's going to be generating this big blue flame that he's going to sort of burn down on. And I mean, the easiest way to make this would be something like ethanol, which you can make in nature, and it does burn with a blue flame. However, the flame is freaking huge within the film. Like, it's this huge stream that he breathes down onto his enemies.
And it's got force behind it, like a lot of force.
So one, that's super dangerous. To anybody that's ever been in a situation where you've attempted to like light your alcohol on fire because you think it's a cool party trick, that can go bad really, really quickly. Yes, the alcohol is heavy. Theoretically, he could breathe this out as sort of like a misting or a solution that would sort of rain down on his enemies. But there's a really high risk, however he goes about generating the flame, that the flame is going to catch and it's actually going to go back into his mouth and into whatever reservoir organ he's using to hold, produce, and spray the ethanol. And at his size, I mean, it would be a very short film if he charged up, turned these blue spikes, shot a big burst of flame, which then went right back into his mouth. Godzilla blew up, and the Muto is like, oh, well.
Guess I'm going to conquer the Earth.
Yeah. So, I mean, I can maybe make something similar to what we've talked about with the dragons before. It's not going to work. It would be severely energy disadvantageous. It would be incredibly risky for him to do. And I don't think the flame would be that long. I think that if he was burning something for safety purposes, it'd be like a couple feet away from his face. Like he could maybe burn something off away from there, but he's not going to spray this big long thing down on his enemies. So alternatively, I played with another mechanism that I think makes a little bit more sense. And there's sort of two parts to this. I think I'm going to go with the second one, but we'll talk about them both. I think it's much more likely that Godzilla is actually going to spew something onto his enemies. I think it's going to have a blue color to it, and whether or not that's because it contains a copper element that's partially oxidized, or whether or not it's because it does contain something like a, I don't know, some other pigment group that's creating sort of a blue color to it. But I think either he's going to spew his gastric contents onto his enemies. Hydrochloric acid is really nasty. If you vomit hydrochloric acid onto something for external digestion, that's going to get the job done. And if you're as big as Godzilla, spewing up gastric contents, that could really work. However, there are major dangers associated with spewing up gastric contents. One, bringing acid up your own esophagus can be really damaging. You can lead to ulcer formation. Mm-hmm. Two, your stomach actually contains a really, really big chunk of your ions. One of the things we worry about in veterinary medicine where an animal's been vomiting for a long period of time is they probably have metabolic imbalances. They've actually messed up their normal pH, and we oftentimes have to try and correct that because you lose a lot of stuff if you vomit up your contents too frequently. So that might be one mechanism. He wouldn't be able to do it very often. I think the other mechanism, which Sam and Adam will get into and see if they can't work this into the ecology next week, that makes way more sense. I think it'd be more likely that he's spraying some sort of toxic, either corrosive or neurotoxic agent onto his prey. So the best examples of this...
Spitting cobra.
Yeah, so spitting venom, the cobra is the best example. There's also a form of scorpion that spits venom.
Yeah.
Interestingly enough, they've looked at both the cobra and the scorpion, and they found that their aim isn't really great. It's not perfect in terms of, like, it's really hard to aim these when you pressurize and spit this material. However, they tend to go for a wide spray. They basically spit it. It's something incredible, like 160-degree angle or something, 190 degrees, to, like, cover the greatest degree of something that's in front of them. Usually the agents that they are spraying actually blind you. They're ototoxic. But you could theoretically produce something inside of a gland that's covered in mucus that you would spray out that would have mild neurotoxic or mild. I don't think they'd go for corrosive because corrosive is really dangerous to contain in yourself, but they could. But if Godzilla's primary food source, which you guys are going to discuss, is probably going to be animals that are smaller than him because everything's going to be smaller than Godzilla, small animals can hide. It would be really advantageous to be able to produce a large amount of a misting compound that you could spray over a large area of all the little creatures that you're trying to eat that would either blind or incapacitate or damage them in such a way that they would not be able to run into their little buildings or their caves or wherever it is to hide and get away from you. And then you could move around the area gathering up your food source.
Yeah.
So I think it's much more likely that that blue material that we're going to see spraying from his mouth is not going to be a flame, it's not going to be atomic, it's just simply going to be some form of material either to blind or incapacitate whatever it is that he's going after.
If he has a high percentage of like vegetation in his diet, does that help at all?
Yeah, actually it would, because he'd be able to make a lot of these active compounds that he'd be using for this a lot easier.
Yeah. Well, that could be a possibility, because we'll get into this next week. Just because something looks like a carnivore doesn't necessarily mean that a high percentage of his diet is going to be meat. We've talked about this before, the fact that European brown bears, these massive fucking things that can kill you with a swipe of their paw, something like 80% herbivorous. They'll take meat when they can get it, of course. Pandas are another great example. I know I'm relying a little bit on bears here, but I mean, if you look at a panda's jaw, that looks exactly like a carnivore. There's nothing herbivorous about it. Yeah. So Godzilla could potentially be eating a lot of plant matter, although, as we'll get into in the ecology section next week, that presents just a whole new set of problems. Yeah.
Okay, that's an interesting point. Yeah, that would actually help him. And again, I don't think he's going to be able to do this super often, in the same way that like cobras and scorpions don't do this super often because it's super energetically costly. Yeah. But I think that's going to be the best way. It's something that's sprayed that irritates the respiratory system or blinds or incapacitates in such a way that he can then eat. Yeah, so that's sort of my discussion. I have a note here on discussing actual radiation expelled, and my notes are, no, this mechanism is stupid, cancer is a thing, and I'm not even going to try. I'm gonna stand by those points and move on. So the next thing we were going to discuss is the absorbing nuclear radiation.
Yeah.
This is not a thing. So for anybody out there that's unfamiliar, the whole big risk that you run into with nuclear radiation is that if the radiation hits you, it moves electrons. And this is super fucking dangerous because it generates something called free radicals. And this is what leads to alterations to your proteins, to your mechanisms, to your DNA at an incredibly low level. This is what leads to the expression of cancer. This is a really big risk. So nothing on the planet is designed in such a way that it can actually, you can survive radiation and you can have mechanisms to better tolerate it at a certain distance. But there's only one creature on the planet that actually uses radiation as an energy source. And it's the radiotrophic fungus. And the radiotrophic fungus, it's believed, work similar to, because I mean, plants survive off of radiation. Solar radiation comes down from the sun, it strikes our plants, they use it to basically bring in carbon dioxide with oxygen to basically stabilize the carbon and generate an energy source that they can use, and that we in turn use. It's the root of all life on the planet. Radiotrophic fungus appear to be able to do this, that they have a pigment type that they're able to convert gamma radiation into a chemical energy that they use for growth. They're super duper rare. And as far as I can tell, Godzilla is not a fungus. He doesn't really look like a fungus.
Yeah, I don't think he fits into any of the common like fungus families.
No.
I think there's just some morphological differences that I don't think we'd be able to get
past. No. So I played with a couple of different mechanisms. So just to answer all the comments of the people that I've read online, because everyone was going on when I was reading through things that, you know, the Earth was super radioactive back in the day. And the answer to that question is yes, actually. There was a lot more unstable uranium-235 back then. We do actually believe that radiation might have been responsible. There's a really cool paper that's just come out that talks about the fact that we think that radiation might have actually generated the heat that created the pools of water where we think the first elements of RNA and DNA formed that eventually led to the first life on the planet. And I mean, that was a huge thing. And we know that there's still a huge supply of radiation and radioactive material that's down near the core. It's responsible for a big chunk of the earthquakes and the other major changes that we see on the planet. Half of that heat goes into generating volcanism and the movement of the tectonic plates. It's just simply from radioactive decay. So the idea that Godzilla is trying to sit closer to those things because he wants to get the radiation, that is true. There is a greater amount of radiation if you're going down further down to the sea floor.
How much of an increase is that, though? Because, I mean, the sheer, like, what's the... Hang on, where is it? Radius of... 6,371 kilometers. The Mariana Trench.
The deepest part of the ocean.
Is 10 kilometers.
Yeah. It's not significant.
It's negligible. Right? It's tiny.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And so he's not going to get any extra material. So this makes absolutely no sense. There are lots of other... So one, you can't feed off of radiation. Two, you're not going to get that much more radiation by being deep. So, however, because we're Cinematica Animalia, I did try to play with some mechanisms to see if there was some way that I could get Godzilla to survive off of radiation. So I tried some ideas where I went through some readings as, is there some way that you can make a symbiotic relationship with a fungus, similar to sort of what we saw in our Ent episode?
Oh, nice. Yeah. Okay, yeah.
Maybe that would be why his spikes glow blue. We know that there are lots of fungus that actually react under UV light and can glow or take on different colorations. Would he be able to get any significant ATP or energy consumptions from this fungus? No. There's no way to connect it to his blood. There's no way to connect it through his skin. There's nothing that would survive in an aquatic environment that the fungus would be okay with. There just isn't something they could do. Now, can I make him semi-resistant to radiation? Yes, I definitely can. Godzilla can take on the same factors that we see within the cockroach or other animals that gives something called radio resistance. So having amazing DNA proofreading mechanisms, alterations in the level of certain types of proteins, increased gene expression to sort of help him. And then the last idea that I saw online was, could he have some type of fungus that's naturally present in his cells? We think that the mitochondria that's in cells is actually a bacteria that our early cells ate and then harnessed. Yes, but he wouldn't do that. It's not a good mechanism. You're not going to expose yourself to radiation because it's super energetically costly. If you're getting blasted by radiation all the time, your cells are going to decay, fall apart. You're going to have to create all these other mechanisms to protect them, and then you're just wasting energy. So the only thing that I could think of that he might use, but again, he's going to run into the same energetically costly mechanisms. He is, in theory, going to be ectothermic. He's going to require, he looks like he's a reptile. Mm. He's an aquatic organism. He's fairly large. He might be generating, I think this is, okay, see, you guys will talk about this.
We know a lot of dinosaurs were endothermic.
Right. So maybe...
I think he's going to be an endotherm. I think he has to be.
Yeah, because the only other mechanism is maybe he was using the radiation to keep himself warm. Maybe that's why he likes to be closer to these radioactive events that he comes in because they're generating amounts of heat. But again, he's still going to be exposing himself to radiation. He's still going to be exposing his tissues to damage. It doesn't make any sense.
Yeah.
And he's not going to be that much warmer. He could just easily go up and get the radiation from the sun and do just fine.
Yeah.
He's a large animal. So,
and I mean,
I'm sorry.
Even if we invent some kind of new mechanism for a creature, that's not going to be, like, with the amount of radiation that was in the Earth at that time, it's not like there's only one creature that's going to have had that. There would have been a huge series of other species that developed that.
Right, mechanism. And people are going to argue, oh, well, the Muto does it too. I would argue that you're not just going to have these ginormous organisms that are the only ones who do it. There'd be a whole bunch of smaller plant-based things that would also have evolved in a similar way. You're not going to. Solar radiation is way easier to use. And then the last thing to sort of talk about in the physiology discussion, and we've talked about this somewhat before, so I'm not going to go into huge detail on it, but I think it still needs to be discussed.
Yes.
You can't do a land aquatic transition if everyone thinks that Godzilla is existing at depths. The whole reason we're led to believe in the film that we haven't seen him forever is because he's living super deep down in the ocean. He, you know, I have no idea what he's doing for an oxygen source that deep down. If he did survive for any period of time below, then theoretically he'd have a gill mechanism and he'd be adapted for pressure. But then, as we've discussed before, if he adapted to exist down there permanently, he would die when he came up to, like, surface atmosphere. So I think it makes much more sense, if we do want him to exist like he is in the film, that he's similar to a whale. He basically swims along. He has a longer tail, more similar to what he sees with an alligator, that helps him to sort of move through the water. He's probably got thicker skin. His skin would have to be a lot smoother. It's scaly and it's broken. It's going to be super increase on drag when he's moving through the water.
Yeah, big time. Those plates on his back, not going
to... And he's probably going to travel closer to the surface, making occasional dives down, which means he's probably got the same alterations to his lungs, to his myoglobin, to his sinuses, like we've talked about in the Little Mermaid episode and in the Aquaman episode. He's also going to have a lot of blubber, which I actually think fits with this. He looks like he's a husky boy, and that I'm okay with. It's just, he's not going to be able to do these types of things. So you guys are going to have to answer the question as to exactly where he was and why no one's seen him before, which I don't think makes any sense. But he's...
It's a big problem. Yeah. But look, his method of dispersal, like the way we see him swimming in the film.
I'm okay with it. Yeah, he's got his feet and his tails in. He's a big organism. He's kind of swimming under the water. He's going to have to come up to breathe. He might have some sort of modified blowhole mechanism. And I think it goes without saying, just because I didn't bring this up in the radiation episode, he's got to be eating something other than radiation.
Yeah.
All right. He's going to be eating plants or people or meat. Meat.
Pods of whales.
Yeah. Whatever.
I don't think...
His metabolism, and I mean, it's going to be through the roof. He's going to have serious metabolic demands that need to be met. He's going to be a very energetically costly animal to be that big.
Yeah. Yes. I mean, Godzilla not eating humans makes total sense here, because there's no way that... Like, he'd have to eat so many humans.
We'd be krill.
Exactly.
He'd have to consume hundreds of tons of us per day.
Yeah. And this is one of the issues that Adam and I are going to run into next week. The fact that there would have to be just... So many issues.
Yeah, his food source would have to be huge. And I imagine we're probably going to run into major problems with the kind of energy that we see him. Like, that fight alone with the two mutos, of which he doesn't eat either of them.
Oh, yeah.
And that's my biggest problem within the film, is that he finishes killing them and then he walks off. No, you don't. If you're a predator that's taken that much damage fighting other creatures, you are going to sit down and chomp. You are going to get your calories in. You're not...
It could be that, this is the issue. Like, not eating carnivores is a thing that a lot of other carnivores will do, just because, you know, the... not the best option for a lot of reasons. But I mean, they subsist on the same food source that he does.
Yeah, and meat is meat.
So, yeah, exactly.
Like, he's brutalized at the end of the film. He's taken a lot of damage. He's going to need a lot of material to help repair all that. He is going to sit down and he's going to chomp. They're going to have this really awkward part of the movie where all the humans are trying to clean up the city. And Godzilla is going to be there for 2 days, just chowing down and probably taking naps in between. All right, he's not going to have this big triumphant leaving New York where everyone's like, he's the hero that we deserve right now. It's not going to happen.
Yeah, that was so... I do not understand that. Like, how do they know that Godzilla's, you know, doing a good thing? For all they've seen is three massive monsters coming and fuck the city up. You would be terrified. Why would you not just be making sure that thing is dead as soon as it hit the
ground? I was expecting a, like, Terminator 2 bit, whereas Godzilla sort of, like, goes down into the water. We just sort of see his thumb rising above the water as it goes down.
Would have been a fun little jab, but I'm glad that didn't happen. Yes. But the other thing I enjoyed about the dispersal mechanism of swimming is that would have to be, you know, kind of side-to-side movement with the tail, which would just fuck up
everything. Any
ship anywhere near
him. He floats underneath ships at some point, and they're watching it. And it's like, no, you wouldn't be watching it. You'd be gripping onto the guardrails as one of the largest tidal waves you've ever seen pulls your ship up and just whips it across the ocean. Yeah. And poor New York, because him coming in, he'd be generating...
San Francisco.
He'd be generating huge tidal waves on his way in. Like, he would arrive to have basically washed out the shoreline.
Yep. Yeah.
Like, thanks, Godzilla.
Yeah. What you gonna do? Look, I hate to say it, but in a lot of ways, the 1998 version is a lot more realistic.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, yeah, and I mean, he's smaller in the 1998 version, so it makes it a lot easier to make him work. No, and I did a lot of reading online. The first thing that I always do for any of these episodes is I go reading through whatever popular mechanics or other groups, and I've seen if other scientists have tried to put together mechanisms online to explain these creatures. And I found a lot of work from really good scientists discussing, like, oh, you know, here are all the problems with his size and his metabolism, everything we've discussed before. I also found a lot of fanboys being like, oh, like, he's the perfect apex predator. He's designed to, like, absorb radiation. And, like, I love the idea. Trust me, I am as big a fanboy in these elements. Watching this film as a kid, I thought this was the coolest freaking thing when I used to watch these. And I'm like, wow, they put so much thought into making him work scientifically. And now that I'm an adult, I am unfortunately here to bring the information that Godzilla would not work.
Yeah. Now, what do we think those plates on his back would actually be for?
What do you mean in turning blue or just having those plates?
Having those plates, like...
The two mechanisms that I played with as to having them are, one, some sort of defensive capacity with other Godzilla creatures. If they did actually have some form of, like, battle for dominance or breeding purposes, they might end up having protections across the spine to basically help in those types of conflicts. And the second was going to be some sort of stabilization mechanism, like a dorsal fin that would be involved in swimming. But the problem is that it have to be more flexible to a certain degree, and it would have to be more centralized. The spikes are uneven, and they're not well distributed in a couple of different areas. I don't think that would be his best go-to, unfortunately.
Because they do look like a couple of things we've seen before in nature. I mean, you do have this sort of thing popping up on some dragons and lizards. Stegosaurus is obviously a really good example.
Yeah,
but I mean, they're still not 100% on what those were used for in Stegosaurus.
No, and I mean, defensive plates, again, I think would be the best, but they're not well distributed for defensive plates. I mean, Stegosaurus, they actually fanned out in a couple of very cool ways. And also, I don't know what would be attacking or eating him besides another form of Godzilla.
Yeah. And that's one thing we're going to have to get into next week. The world that they've created here with these enormous predators everywhere. Like, it just... Anyway, I think that about wraps it up. Is there anything else you want to go into just quickly?
Yeah, I think I'm happy with this episode. I think there were lots of topics that I could touch on, from hibernation to aquatic travel, and I'm happy with the subjects that I chose to focus on.
In the year 2023, the world faces an unstoppable evil.
Godzilla has destroyed the last of our Air Force, sir. We have one final option.
Nuclear?
Better. Jason Voorhees! He can't be killed!
Think Hollywood is out of ideas? Shut up!
Okay, so you want to take us through your PSA for this week?
So the PSA that I want to talk about this week, just because it has popped up a number of times at work, and this is not a criticism, because I have worked in these areas and I have worked in these countries doing volunteer work and things like that. Animals that are coming from other countries bring a wide variety of diseases, and I think that it's a really, really noble and super awesome thing that a lot of people do, that they want to try and adopt from, you know, areas in South America or areas in Africa to try and rescue these animals from these types of situations. But one, we have to be aware that oftentimes they arrive and they've got diseases and things like that that need to be looked at. So when you go into your regular veterinarian and you're like, what's going on, it takes some research to figure out, like, I've never run into this. It's not a big problem in Canada. And two, it's not a bad idea to get new vaccinations. Oftentimes they come from these areas and the vaccines might be old or used up, because a lot of the areas that are sending these animals are volunteer areas that might not be able to actually hire a full-time veterinarian to do a lot of things. Mm-hmm. And having worked in these areas, I definitely saw a number of times where animals would get shipped out because they really wanted them to get a home, but they didn't have the money at the time to properly vaccinate or take care of them. And then they would get sent over without the proper, but there would still be some sort of signature or paper saying, like, oh, they've been vaccinated for this disease. So getting them taken care of when they arrive in Canada, if you adopt such an animal that's coming from those areas, having a veterinarian look them over, redo their vaccinations, redo their deworming protocols, and discuss what the risks are from coming with those areas. Just do a little bit of research before you bring those animals in.
Yep.
And please, I know this is not always the most popular idea, but consider adopting internally. people spend a lot of money shipping these animals over from other countries, and then they get here and they don't really have the money for the veterinary capabilities or to take care of the sick animals. If instead you spend $100 adopting that animal from your local shelter, I know that it's not as dramatic as, you know, bringing in a saved animal from Costa Rica or wherever else it is, but it leaves you with a lot more funds that you can put towards care of that animal in Canada or the United States or in Norway or wherever it is that you're living.
A lot more sustainable too.
Yeah. And I mean, not that I want to harsh on that, and I definitely want people to adopt and save animals from everywhere. I just want them to think about what they're going to do if they get sick long term.
Anyway, that's us done for the week. We will be back next week. Looking at the ecology of Godzilla, we'll go through the issues of having a creature that size walking around on the planet. A species that size walking around the planet, I should say. As well as like this whole idea of two creatures fighting, bringing balance to an ecosystem sort of thing.
So dumb.
And a little bit on evolution, because apparently they claim that he's evolved since the last movie in this new one that's out here. Hopefully I'll have had time to see it by next week.
Okay, I definitely need to try that as well.
Anyway, in the meantime, you can find us at cinematicaanimalia.com, or if you want to get at us with any questions, concerns, we're cinematicaanimalia@gmail.com. I'm on Twitter at samperinntnu. You can find Adam at harsikadam. You can find the show's Twitter at c_animalia. If you want to check out the kind of more hardcore science that Adam and I do, that's accessible for a really wide range of people, you don't have to be an ecologist to get into it. It's ecologyforthemasses.com. And we'll see you next week. As we always say, the monsters aren't real, but the science is.
See you guys.
Baby. Bye-bye.